Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, the speaker is Michael Pallett, and he will be speaking on transfigurative obedience. So let's listen in on Michael.
I think that the way in which Mark writes his gospel and the reason he wants to say that is kind of because he's not ready for that, you know, that kind of word to be out in, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's the concern that they aren't to say it yet because they don't get it. Right? It's always, it goes along with that question, do you not yet understand? And the kind of implied answer there, no, we really don't understand. And so if you don't understand, then you shouldn't be saying, I am the Messiah. Because what being the Christ, being the Messiah is all about takes that understanding of what? The cross. Right? See, again, when somebody understands, and that's part of the irony of Mark's gospel, right? The Roman centurion, right, seeing how Jesus dies, understands, and so he does say, this is the Son of God. This is the Messiah. When we understand, I mean, I think Mark's message to us as disciples, as followers of Jesus, is to say, and when we understand that, that's precisely when we too proclaim Jesus is the Christ, Jesus is the Messiah. But it fits in, I think, with that, as we'll get in again today, the hearing speaking. It's the kind of thing, don't talk until you have first heard what I am saying. Right? And see, the problem with the disciples, and this will come in here, right? The problem with the disciples, and again, Peter in particular as that character, is they're always talking and not listening. And that's why they come under Jesus' strong rebuke. Okay. This morning, we'll look at Mark chapter 9, verses 2 through 29. And there are kind of three sections in there. And the first section is chapter 9, verses 2 through 8. And that's the account of the transfiguration. And that's what I will spend most of the time on. It's just a fantastic story with all sorts of things in it that we'll look at. Verses 9 through 13 of chapter 9 serve as a transition. Right? It's kind of here, coming down the mountain. And just a little comment by Mark on what he understands Elijah to be, and connecting again the Hebrew tradition and scriptures with who Jesus is and what Jesus does. And then verses 14 through 29 is the healing of the epileptic boy. But for Mark, again, what this is going to serve is really, a discourse on faith. What faith is all about. So that the purpose, again, is not the healing serves as a teaching about faith. So that this becomes the important thing. All of this, chapter 9 here yet, is in the context of the first passion prediction. Remember in chapter 8, we have Peter saying to Jesus, you are the Christ. But then that question, did Peter understand that or not? Right? There was that question about, did he get it right Or didn't he get it right? So we look at that. We see that he then follows the first passion prediction, where Jesus says, I must go to Jerusalem, suffer, die, rise again. And we then get the sense that Peter didn't get it right, because Peter rebukes Jesus, and in turn, Jesus rebukes Peter, right? Get behind me, Satan. And we talked about that yesterday in terms of what that's all about. But after that rebuke, we had what we call, right, kind of at that point, even given Peter and the other disciples misunderstanding, there was the teachable moment, right, where Jesus talks about to follow him, to be one of his followers, is to take up, is to deny ourselves, take up our cross, follow Jesus, and what that means. So there's that teachable moment. This whole section still follows under this first passion prediction. And for Mark yet, this whole section, the transfiguration and the healing, are still all part of this first teachable moment. All right, if you will, it stretches out over the whole week. Kind of a week later, we're still on this. Now why is this? And I think to say the teachable moment. Because the passion prediction, right? Remember, we are, as I said, earlier in the week. And for those of you who aren't here, I can outline this very brief. That within Mark's gospel, we kind of have two different kinds of disciples. We have the stupid disciples, which are like Peter and all the others in the gospel. And we have the smart disciples. And that's us, the reader. And we as reader are smart disciples because we know the answer to all the questions that Mark is trying to get at. Namely, who is Jesus? Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. We know that already right from chapter 1, verse 1. The other disciples don't know that, right? They're following Jesus throughout the entire gospel to come to that conclusion. And so that's why we're the smart disciples. We know that ahead of time. But now, even as smart disciples, here in back in chapter 8, with the passion prediction, we're confronted with something new as well that we need to think about. That for Jesus to be the Christ, to be God's special agent of salvation who carries out God's will, to be the Christ means the cross, right? Just to summarize that passion prediction in one word. So that Christ and cross go together. And the question there is, ooh, right? Is that really the case? What does that mean? What does that mean for us as disciples, as followers of Jesus, if Christ and cross go together? Right? Peter certainly says, no, that can't be the case. That won't work. And Jesus rebukes him again. And so, okay, that first teachable moment is Jesus tells us what it means for us if Christ and cross go together. But what it means, again, right, is such a radical way of reorienting our lives and refocusing our lives, we still have the question to say, but is this really who God is and what God is about? And at that point, the transfiguration comes in to say, yes, it is. Right. The transfiguration at that point is for our sake, for the sake of the disciples. If you will, Jesus doesn't need to go up to the mountain and be transfigured. Jesus doesn't need to have Moses and Elijah appear and say, this is what you're supposed to do. It's been there all along. Jesus doesn't need the voice from heaven. But we do. And Mark characterizes that in three different verses. Let me just point that out. First of all, in chapter 9, verse 2, right, as they go up to the mountain, Peter, James, and John, and it says, and he was transfigured before them. It's for the sake of the disciples. Jesus is transfigured before them. And again, here again, I think as readers always read there as well, he is transfigured before us. We see again who Jesus is. In verse 4, and there appeared to them Elijah with Moses. There appeared to them, to the disciples, and thus to us, Moses and Elijah. Moses, who is often spoken of as the person who characterizes the law, the Torah, God's instruction. Elijah, who is often understood to be one of the key and most important prophets. So I think it's a way to talk about in image again that what appears when Moses and Elijah appear, what appears are the law and the prophets, which is another Hebrew or Jewish way of saying what appears to these disciples in the two figures of Moses and Elijah is basically the entire testimony of the Hebrew Scriptures. Right? That when Moses and Elijah are before the disciples, when Moses and Elijah are before us, Mark is saying, right, whenever the Scriptures are before us, and here again for their community, that would mean the only Scriptures they have at this time are the Hebrew Scriptures, right? Old Testament. Whenever that Old Testament is there, we have Moses and Elijah in front of us. They appear to us, right? Their word, their witness, just like to those disciples, comes to us, the law and the prophets. And so, again, that transfiguration is for our sake. And finally, in verse 8, suddenly when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. Right? That, again, with them, with us, but who finally is always with them or with us? Who is the focal point, or who is the focus of all of this? Only Jesus. So that finally, again, in terms of discipleship and for our understanding to say, as followers of Jesus, what do we need to focus on? What is the center? Right? And there could be all sorts of candidates for that, but Mark's word to us is to say, remember, disciples, the focus of discipleship is Jesus. And he puts that then, right, with an exclusive particle. Only Jesus. In the sense of, right, what you need, right, what is necessary for Christian discipleship is Jesus. Other things might be helpful, useful, nice, but they're not necessary, right? The necessary thing to have with us for our discipleship is Jesus. Only Jesus. Right? And that's going to be, again, the focal point of this transfiguration story and what's there. Secondly, to talk a bit about the context. So again, we can see this is going to be about discipleship because the transfiguration story is told for our sake as disciples, and it's going to be told again to help us learn and understand something about discipleship. The other thing about the transfiguration and discipleship is we're going to see in here how it fits in again with Mark's understanding of how the Exodus is a model or a paradigm for discipleship, and how the transfiguration again fits into this Exodus model. Within the Hebrew understanding of when God provides key moments of revelation and insight to God's people, this always happens up on a mountain. Can you think of instances in the Old Testament when God appears to folks on mountains, and to whom does God appear? Anybody?
Moses.
Right? God appears to Moses, right, up there on Mount Sinai. Any other times when God appears on mountains to someone or whatever?
Elijah is still small.
Elijah, right. We have Elijah and the still small voice. Again, in Kings, the tradition there talks about Mount Horeb, but often Horeb and Sinai are understood to be the same places. So again, right, for Mark, it is not by accident, right, that the two folks who show up on the mountain are folks who, if you will, have already had mountain experience, right? Moses and Elijah. It's not that Mark is saying, or if you will, the transfiguration is coming here to say, we got to have some folks appear there, need some prophets, let's say two prophets, let's pick two prophets, any two prophets, right? No, very intentional here. These, right, up on the mountain where God has already appeared and given God's word and God's assurance. And so it's to these prophets who have been on the mountain, who again, right, are able to come before us and to us and say, yes, this is who God is. This is what God is about. We know, we have heard those words before. We have heard that assurance before. And of course, both of those places happening in Sinai or on Mount Horeb, out there in the wilderness, again takes us back to that notion of the Exodus. It is after coming out of Egypt, wandering in the wilderness, which Mark understands as the wilderness experience for Israel was God's time to teach Israel what it meant to live as God's people. Right. So that, again, to kind of use this phrase, the wilderness was a teachable moment for God. 40 years of teachable moments. Right? Maybe they were slow learners. But here again, with that sense of Exodus, we who are disciples always on the way, right, who live that Exodus kind of life, part of our Exodus are those moments when what? God appears to us. God comes to us with God's word of assurance and instruction. And so Mark wants to set that up again. This all fits within his context. And we as the smart disciples, right, hear that, understand that, and see that now as part of our context. And so that's where we begin. Now, having that as the context of what we're about, right, we can now go on to look at the transfiguration itself. And when we do that, we see in I think typical fashion in Mark that he presents this event to us in terms of humor and irony. That really, after reading the transfiguration account, we should be laughing. The fact that most of us don't laugh after reading the transfiguration account shows that we didn't get it. In a sense, we take it too seriously in that we don't catch the irony. And that's what I want to spend some time here talking about, to show you some of the irony that's going on. And that irony comes out in verses 5 and 6. Let me read that from the New Revised Standard Version. Chapter 9, verse 5. And again, of course, it's going to be Peter, Rocky Johnson, the Rocky disciple, who's going to be the spokesperson. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Now, if we'd stop there, that doesn't sound too bad, does it? But then note Mark's comment. He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Right? I mean, that sentence there, Mark is already giving us the indication that Peter got it all wrong again. Poor Peter is all loused up. He didn't know what to say. But on the same hand, right, I mean, at that point, we should be scratching our heads a little bit and say, oh, but what Peter said sounds pretty good. I mean, if you look at that carefully, right, I mean, to say, first of all, right, he says, "Rabbi," so that he addresses Jesus with respect. I mean, think back here in the Passion prediction. I mean, Peter was very disrespectful. I mean, he comes in there and rebukes Jesus. Peter goes, "Shut up, Jesus! Right? Don't talk like that, Jesus!" Now he says, "Rabbi." Or, of course, if he would be in Germany, he would have said, "Herr Professor." Right? I mean, true respect for his teacher. I mean, that's pretty good. Right? The second phrase there, right? "It is good for us to be here." Right? Appreciation. "Thank you, Jesus, for sharing this moment with us. It is a life-changing experience, something that I could have never gotten on my own, but you have provided it for me," right? It's good to be here. So appreciative. And that. The third little phrase there, "Let us make three dwellings." Again, that the notion of "let us make," in that sense, Peter is very deferential, right? It's not, again, that kind of Peter who rebukes and says, "Jesus, I know what to do. Here's the plan. Follow me," right? But this time, you know, like, it's the "let us make," or if you will, "Jesus, do you think that this would be a good idea?" Right? So again, he's, right, in that sense, he's learned his lesson from a week ago in terms of that. Very deferential, you know, trying to get Jesus' approval, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, "let us make the booths" and all of that, something that we all like when people, right, he volunteers, and the other two disciples, you can assume, go along with it. He volunteers to do the work.
All right.
Now you think about that to say, wouldn't this be four key characteristics of what you think a good disciple should be? As a follower of Jesus, wouldn't we want to have respect for Jesus? Certainly we should show appreciation of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done for us. We should always be deferential, right? That Jesus' will and what Jesus wants should be done rather than just what we want. And, of course, as good disciples, we would want to be the ones to do the work. Right? We're in there working for you, Jesus. I mean, all of that. And, right, Mark says, you look at that and he didn't know what to say. Right? 'Cause he was afraid. That all of this respect, appreciation, deference, and willingness to work came out of fear. And as it, again, as we'll see later in the rest of it, right? Not faith. And the Greek word for fear is phobia, right? Phobos. Fear, but there is a prefix on that again, as they try to translate it here, they were terrified, right? That's the kind of fear. It led to almost absolute terror. Or if you'll excuse a kind of crass understanding about that, it's the kind of thing that seeing what they saw, the disciples just about filled their pants. Right, that's the kind of fear we're talking about. And the kind of term here that's used, again, I think a sense of humor that, you know, that's what's going on. And the kind of behavior that goes there. One example that I can think of that might be to characterize this and how often these things do come out of fear and not out of faith. Right? I mean, you're leaving Holden Village today, you're getting out, hopefully you'll get to Fields Point, you'll get in your car, and you know, finally we're away from legume land, and we're going to zip down to Wenatchee just as fast as we can to get that McDonald's hamburger and get our bodies used to junk food one more time. So we're zipping along, and all of a sudden, and the police pull us over. You know, I was speeding and all of that. And so, right, the officer comes up. I roll down my window and say, good afternoon, officer. How's the fire? I hope things aren't too bad. And he goes, well, you know, you were speeding. Oh, well, I just got back from Holden Village. I didn't know that. I guess I was. You know, thank you for telling me that, right? I'm very appreciative at this point and all of that. And, you know, and very different. Oh, I was? Well, I'm sure you were looking, and I just wasn't paying attention, you know. And I won't let that happen again. And, you know, I'm going to check around to make sure everybody else has their seatbelts fastened properly. You know, right? In fear of getting a ticket, I can become very respectful and appreciative and deferential and volunteer to do all sorts of things to that officer. Right? Now that's just kind of a silly example, but you've been in situations where you've probably done that same kind of thing. Right? Now up the ante here, right, to say we're confronting God. Right? This transfiguration, that kind of experience, and at this point, right, that's the sense Peter is speaking out of fear. He is speaking out of the sense of, what do I have to do so I'm not going to die? Because remember, again, within the Hebrew tradition, there is that notion that what? The one who sees God, or if anyone sees God, they will die. So part of the reason Peter is saying this is he is in fear of his life. And so he's just going to babble on and say anything. Saying, maybe it'll work, maybe it'll help me, I'm going to do this. Right? And that's why the terror. And as that goes on, then, you know, verse 7 comes in, and this is where I think the humor comes in. A cloud overshadowed them. From the cloud there came a voice, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." Again, the grammar is in the Greek is a participial clause. And so you could understand this to say, while this is going on, right? While Peter is babbling, the cloud comes in and the voice speaks. And so the humor in this is that while Peter is doing all this talking, you know, finally God decides, I can't be polite any longer. And God says, excuse me, Peter, I'd like to talk now. It's again, we can see from Mark's understanding, Peter's got it all backwards. That as we've looked at previous times, for Mark, the understanding of discipleship is that what? First, there is hearing, and from hearing, right, once you hear clearly, you can then speak clearly. You can do clearly. Think again, this is what was the key point in chapter 7, verses 31 to 39, the healing of the deaf mute. Right? The person couldn't speak because he couldn't hear properly. Hearing properly meant he could speak plainly. So that for Mark, again, the sense of discipleship is hearing followed by speaking, followed by doing. Right? Peter's got it all backwards again. What's Peter doing? He's speaking. And the thing here is, it's not even coherent speaking again. One could look at this. Peter's just babbling on, just like I might be babbling on to the officer. Oh yeah, I'll never, you know, anything not to get a ticket. Say anything, right? I'm desperate. Say anything. Peter's desperate. He'll say anything. You know, you want a booth? I'll give you a booth. Oh, you want tent? I'll give you. I'll volunteer for anything. You know. Want your clothes washed? Okay, here we go, right? I mean, babble, babble, babble. And all of that babbling goes on until finally, right, if you will, into this, God must interject, right, and say, excuse me, but, right, this is my son, my beloved, which was precisely the same words that the voice from heaven said at the baptism, right? Back in Mark chapter 1. This is my son, my beloved. But now again, right? There's the little addendum, the next sentence. Right? Listen to him! And that's the humor and all, right? Peter, talk, 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 and finally God just says, listen! Right? That the key to discipleship again is listening. And so therefore, us as disciples, we have to think about it. Is it that we are so busy talking that we never hear what God is saying? Is it that we're so busy doing, and again a sense of talking and doing like this babbling and running around kind of frenetically but having no real purpose, that we again don't listen to what God is saying? Luther often refers to the church as the Mundhaus. Right? That Luther says the church, when we think about it, is the mouth house.
Right.
Because again, as followers of Jesus, as people of God, as Christian community, yes, we are the mouth house because we are speaking.
Right.
We are talking, praising, witnessing, proclaiming. But here I think that Mark would even want to say to Luther, and I think Luther would agree with him, but to say, you know, sometimes church as mouth house, we become so preoccupied with ourselves, right? We take that notion of mouth house with such seriousness that we forget before to speak, we need to listen. And so to say, what are we, or who are we as church today, as this mouth house? Is our mouth housedness, if you'll allow that term to stand, true speaking as disciples, or is our mouth housedness like Peter's mouth housedness, and that we're babbling? And that the challenge Mark presents to us again about discipleship in terms of our speaking is, are we truly witnessing to who Jesus is and what Jesus does, right? Christ and cross and all that that entails for discipleship. Or are we just kind of babbling on about this, that, and the other, mainly doing that out of, again, fear and not out of faith? How do we sort out those issues? That's the challenge to us. That's the kind of transfiguration that we as disciples need to undergo. That transfiguring to hearing and listening, right? It's the kind of thing that in all of this, right, does God every now and then have to kind of tap us on the shoulder and say, excuse me, I'd like to talk now. Because we're so big that God almost has to butt right in. I mean, that I think that's the humor in the story, that we don't give God a chance to talk.
This seems very instructive regarding our prayer lives.
Mm-hmm.
If prayer is communicating with God, it seems rather strange that we fill every millisecond of our prayers with sounds and words, and maybe at least, to be generous, half of the time of our prayer should be silent listening.
Yes, that's and that anticipates the very end, chapter 29, where Jesus talks about prayer. And I think that for Mark, precisely the notion for Mark, if you want to say it very quickly, of a theology of prayer, most of us would say, oh, what is prayer all about? Oh, prayer is talking to God. That's not bad, but I think Mark would want to say, no, what I understand prayer to be, prayer and what prayer is about for a disciple is listening to God. So that, again, if we're worried about our prayer lives and the kind of thing, oh, it's so hard to set aside an hour every day to pray because, my goodness, I can't think of stuff to say for a whole hour. I mean, I'm kind of done after 2 minutes, right? I covered it all. Well, to say, well, stop babbling. Look at your prayer life is to say, I'm going to set aside, purposefully, intentionally set aside that hour a day, half, whatever, to what? Listen to God. To let God address me rather than my addressing God. And sure, to talk, to respond, all of that, to speak, that's there too. I mean, Mark is not going to deny that. But again, for his sense of discipleship, hearing always has priority, comes first. And so in a theology of prayer too, right, before we can speak to God, we need to hear what God has to say.
I think you're right in Peter's response there is out of fear. I think that's totally right. I get a kick out of it all, but he's the only one that did talk. And I think, and I sense that that is courage on his part, even though it's babbling. I suspect the others were so scared and they didn't have the courage to respond. And I guess that notion of listening is right on, but I also just get a kick out of it that at least Peter had the courage to respond.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think we are caricaturing Peter here as, you know, again, kind of the spokesperson of the stupid disciple and all of that. But again, we don't want to be totally negative in the sense of saying, Peter is absolutely wrong all the time. I mean, it is that sense. Yes, he is the one who speaks. And Mark always makes it clear at various points that, yes, Peter is the one that speaks, but the other disciples always go along with him. In other words, they're in agreement with him. So it's just not Peter's fault. But Peter, as that literary character in this, right, in Mark's disciple, is the spokesperson. Yeah, he has the courage.
Although sometimes I think we speak because we're anxious about silence. In other words, in a conversation and I'm talking with you and you're quiet, well, then I've got to fill that space with some sort of words. And I think we're, like in worship, you know, we're really anxious about built-in times of silence. You know, did something go wrong? Did he lose his mind? What's going on here? And I have a sense a little bit about Peter that he was anxious about the silence.
Could be. But again, I think even, right, the courage to speak or whatever, the anxiety, I think that from the story itself, Mark wants it to be very clear that Peter is speaking out of, you know, fear, anxiety, even, you know, that fear motivates a courage to speak, or that fear heightens the anxiety over silence and he's got to speak. But the bottom line that Mark wants to show is the, right, this is where the problem is. Peter speaks out of fear, not faith. And that often our discipleship is a discipleship some more motivated by fear than it is by faith. Right? And for all sorts of reasons. It can be a fear in terms of anxiety. You know, what are people going to think if I don't say anything, if I don't do anything? Or it can be one even that comes out of courage. Well, I'm a disciple. I can do that. Sure, let's go ahead. Because if I don't, then what will people think of me? Right? That'll look bad. And so on either side, I think those can be all part of it. But fear is the what Mark wants to challenge here. Another point in this sense of listen to him. Note here again that voice from heaven, God's voice, that is totally and completely satisfied, if you will, that Jesus is a viable expression of God. Right? I mean, to say the voice from heaven could have said, you know, this is my son, my beloved. Listen to me. Right? Listen to what I, God, this voice am saying. But the object, right? God directs our listening. The voice directs our listening to whom? Jesus. And again, as that ends, right? That's why Moses and Elijah and all the others can leave, and who is left with the disciples? Only Jesus. Because that's sufficient. Right? God, in that sense, if you will, God is saying, no, you don't need any razzle-dazzle from heaven. You don't need anything else but what? Jesus, right? Listen to him. That sense there, that affirmation that says, listening to Jesus is listening to me.
Right.
There again, that assurance to say, well, you mean when Jesus says, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, suffer, die, rise again, is that God speaking? Is that God's way and will of salvation? This is the clear affirmation. Yes, it is. If you will, God is saying, Jesus is my spokesperson. What Jesus says is what I say. His word is my word. Clear identification is made there, right? So again, that reassurance that Jesus is the Christ, is God's will for us. So listen to Jesus. The other thing about the word listen, a word in Greek, akouta, the imperative that says listen, is also the same word as obey. So that when God says listen to him, it could also be properly translated as obey him. Or to kind of bring those two together, the translation that for my own translation, what it says here is kind of do what he says. Right? That listening to Jesus is do what he says. That's listening and obeying. Often our notion of obeying is something like, right, there's a whole bunch of rules and now we're supposed to follow them. That's a very narrow and reductionistic understanding of obey. Just to do a little word play here, right, for all of you who wonder, is there any reason that we should still learn Latin? Probably not, but since I did, I'll play with it a little, okay? The word obey or obedience, right, comes from two Latin words, ob, which is a prefix that means to or toward, and audire, right, audit, auditory, right, audio, all of those things, which means, right, hear or listen. So that again, in Latin, like in Greek, the notion of obey picks up on the word of listen. So that to say, if you are obedient, what we are talking about is to whom are you listening? Right. For example, if someone says, oh, that's an obedient child. Really, what are we saying, basically, is that child listens to its parents or to whoever, right? And so again, for discipleship, when we are talking about obedience, right, Mark's question to us, again, is to whom are you listening? You see, again, Peter's problem is he wasn't listening to Jesus. He wasn't listening to God, and therefore could not be obedient. Again, we as the church in the mouth house, the reason that we might be babbling on is, again, the question, to whom are we listening to? Right? The world is bombarded with all sorts of voices and sounds proclaiming all sorts of things. Right? Some politicians say, do this. Other folks, do that. But to whom are we listening? A notion of obedience, right? If you'll allow me to kind of make up a word here, I think is a notion of attunement. Think about it as a radio, right? We are bombarded by all sorts of radio signals. They're all out there. But unless you do a little fine tuning, you're never going to get any station clearly. You'll get static and this, that, and the other. But you need to do that fine tuning to get a clear signal. The life of discipleship, what I think Mark is telling us here, is that life of attunement. That life which says we must adjust our hearing, our fine-tuning, so that what? Jesus speaks clearly. So that we hear his word, God's word. And when there is that attunement, right, when there is that clear signal and that clear hearing, then we'll follow clear speaking. If you get a fuzzy message, right, if you only get the radio station and it cuts in and out all the time, you really didn't hear it well, and so you don't know what's going on. I mean, did they say the fire's here, the fire's there? I don't know. It cut in and out. I'm not clear. And so now because you're not clear, what? You don't know what to do. Should I go? Should I stay? Do I go down to Chelan? Do I try Fields Point? I don't know what to do. Why? I didn't hear clearly. So again, a garbled message, no clear speech. Right? You gotta tune that receiver. And so, if you know, at least one suggestion about obedience to think about a contemporary metaphor. Right? We're radios, we're TVs, whatever, and we need that fine-tuning, because unless that happens, right, without a clear signal, there won't be a clear message. Right? We won't be able to speak and communicate clearly. The other interesting thing, just to keep the little wordplay in Latin, the opposite of to listen to would be to be deaf to. Right? And again, that's a play on Mark 2, to be deaf toward or to be deaf to someone. If you look at that in Latin, what that would entail, the word again for to or toward is ob, the word for deafness is sordus, right? Or we'll just say here the word surd. So the interesting thing is that the opposite of obedience is what? Absurdity. Yeah. And again, right, don't we see what Peter is doing here, right? Finally, Mark's word to us is that Peter, who doesn't hear clearly, what? Engages in absurdity. Peter engages in absurd behavior. He didn't know what to say. Mark's saying, why is that? Because he's deaf. He didn't hear. And when you don't hear, you do absurd things. So again, the kind of challenge, I think, that Mark puts in front of us is to say, right, personally and communally, as people of God, what kind of absurdities are we engaged in? We could really get going on this one. How many absurdities do we as church engage in? Right, we could go on probably for hours on that. How many, you know, what kind of absurdities do we as individuals and as followers of Jesus engage in? Huh? And again, right, hearing is first. Please.
That business about the radio is kind of interesting. I was thinking that I think a real good analogy, and I think all of us, at least for me myself, I don't think my radio ever is finely tuned. I think that's part of being human, and that we're never quite on the signal. And if we are, just for a little bit of time, then we kind of float off. And what I appreciate about the Lord is that that's okay. Mm-hmm. And at least that, what you're all saying, that kind of fits for me. And that's a real good way of looking at it.
And again, just to time, I want to give folks a chance to talk and comment on this, so I'm not going to say any more about this, develop more. But precisely your point is, as Mark develops this, when we get to the healing miracle, I want to point that out in verse 24. Right, in terms of the father of this epileptic boy, you know, Jesus says that, you know, if, with regard to faith, all things can be done for one who has faith. Immediately the father of the child cried out, I believe, help my unbelief. Mm-hmm. Or again, in Greek there, the word would really be like faith. It's like, I have faith, help my unfaith. Right? It's like, well, you know, I've got my radio tuned, but it always seems to get out of tune. Help me tune it again. So that, you know, sometimes I think we as Christians think that doubt is bad, right? That, oh, well, you know, sure, I believe, sure, I trust, but, you know, I sometimes have doubts and mistrusts and all of that. And Mark is telling us that the opposite of faith is not necessarily doubt. Doubt can already, or at least certainly recognition of doubt, is already a sign of faith. Because why would you be concerned about doubt unless you had some faith that says, well, you know, I'm worried about this, right? The opposite of faith is not doubt, but, right, absurdity, deafness, right? Not listening at all. To be concerned about the quality of listening or whatever is already something that comes out of faith. So that I have faith, I don't have faith, you know, is at the same time. If you will, for Lutherans again, it's Luther saying we're at the same time saints and sinners. Right? That at the very same moment we act in faith and unfaith. And that, you know, if you will, Jesus does not condemn that, but Jesus said, I can work with that, right? I mean, that there's where the graciousness of God says, sure, I understand the ambiguity of human life. And I'm there for that, right? That person is not rebuked by Jesus, but that person receives Jesus' help, aid, comfort, healing. Yeah. So again, good point. And Mark tries to work that out. Any other questions, comments? What do you think about reading the Transfiguration like this? I mean, like I said, seeing the humor in it, again, the irony. Mark wants us to laugh at the disciples, and most importantly, laughing at the disciples again is a recognition of laughing at ourselves, at our babblings and our absurdities. And you know what funny people we are.
I think you have made the point very beautifully that this story was really for the sake of the disciples then and now. It occurs to me, in addition to that, that just as the voice came from the cloud when Jesus was baptized, and maybe this really helped him as a human being to get a clearer picture of who he was and what he was in this world to accomplish. So also, that maybe the voice coming from the cloud now, before these god-awful things were going to happen in Jerusalem soon, was also for his benefit, a real confirmation to him as a human being of who he was, and sort of a pep talk before the cross.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I think one could say that certainly to emphasize Jesus' humanity, that as human, Jesus too needs confirmation, affirmation, assurance. But I think the way Mark sets it up, precisely because of these little prepositional phrases, his main target is, right, the transfiguration happens not for Jesus' sake, but for our sake, right? We need to be transfigured. I mean, or in Jesus being transfigured, we are transfigured. Transfigured in terms of, again, right, this sense of hearing, listening, obeying. Right? We are reoriented once again in terms of, okay, this is what discipleship is about. Listening to Jesus. Right? We're always reoriented. We're transfigured, reformed. Right? I mean, another, in Greek, transfigure, figure would be like morphe or formed. We could almost talk about this as the reformation of Jesus, which is really, again, our reformation. Right? Our reformation, the reformation keeps going and going. Each and every day we need to be reformed, reshaped, reoriented, so that we listen again.
Especially if we're going to have any chance at all of denying ourselves, taking up our cross and following Him, which has just preceded this.
Right, right. In order to do that, we need to hear this every day. Or again, as Luther would say, right, daily remembering our baptism. Because in that sense, if we get into our kind of sacramental theology as Lutherans, you could say baptism is our transfiguration, isn't it? When we are transfigured from sinners to saints. Right? As Luther would say, the old self drowns and dies, and the new self is raised and comes forth, right? Our baptism is a death and resurrection. Right? Quite a radical transfiguration, isn't it? And so, in that sense, one can, if you know, to push how broadly can this be seen, one can see this story as also fitting in with our understandings of baptism.